Chapter 6 When Heaven Was Young. For the whole of recorded human history, many traditions and tales have survived where humans in a state of meditation or reverie have encountered glowing balls of fire of a divine nature. Let us take a look now at some of these ancient accounts. They provide historic evidence of great importance to us. About 2,000 years ago, there was a very widespread religious tradition in the Middle East and Mediterranean based upon what we would now call plasma entities. It was a light theology called Gnosticism. There were many schools and groups and churches of Gnosticism, somewhat similar to the way in which there are many Protestant sects today. The word Gnostic is a modern invention, which scholars use to describe them collectively. It comes from the Greek word gnosis, which starts with a G, which means knowledge. But amongst the people we now call the Gnostics, the word took on a deeper meaning of sacred knowledge or of higher knowledge. The Gnostics believed that an elect group of people of spiritual inclinations who pursued sacred knowledge would constitute the section of the human population who would survive the vicissitudes of the corrupt world of physical matter and after their physical deaths would enter a kingdom of light, in which resided a variety of plasmic deities, culminating in the Father. This was a name they used for the highest God of all. Jesus used this very term himself, and instead of speaking of the kingdom of light, he spoke of the kingdom of the Father. The light emitted by the Father is described in Gnostic texts as being stronger than 10,000 times 10,000 suns. The Father had no physical body, but was essentially what might perhaps be called a light ball or plasma ball. Those who were saved would themselves put on vestures of light and become mini plasma balls and would live forever in a heavenly plasma world. In the lengthy and well-preserved Gnostic text known as the Pistis Sophia, the following conversation between Mary Magdalene, who in the Gnostic tradition was one of the main disciples of Jesus, and Jesus is recorded. Maria came forward. She worshipped at the feet of Jesus and said, "My Lord, be not angry with me that I question thee, for thou hast once said to us, 'Seek and ye shall find.' My Lord and my Savior, of what kind are the 24 invisible ones, and of what type? Or what form are they? Or of what form is their light?" Jesus answered, however, and said to Maria, "What is there in this world that resembles them? Or rather, what place is there in this world that is comparable to them? Truly, truly, I say to you, the 24 invisible ones are lighted 10,000 times more than the light of the sun which is in this world, as I have already said to you at another time. For the light of the sun in its true form is not in this place, because its light passes through a multitude of veils of places. But the light of the sun in its true form, which is in the place of the Virgin of the Light, is lighted 10,000 times more than the 24 invisible ones, and the great invisible forefather, and also the triple-powered God, as I have already said to you at another time. Now at this time, Maria, there is no kind in this world, nor light nor form, which compares with the 24 invisible ones. But yet a little, and I will take thee with thy brothers and fellow disciples to all the places of the height, and you will look forth upon the whole world of mankind, and it will become the size of a speck of dust before you as a result of the great distance." Gnosticism was strong in both Judaism and in Christianity, though we know that it existed in Judaism long before Jesus, so was earlier than the earliest forms of Christianity. We should bear in mind that Jesus was not a Christian, but a Jew. Christianity had not been invented yet. It was named later, based upon his sayings, after the Greek word Christos, meaning anointed, which was itself a direct translation of the Hebrew word Mashiach, which we pronounce Messiah, which also means anointed. The Jewish Gnostics had an esoteric and secret reinterpretation of the Old Testament texts, maintaining that the book of Genesis was an allegory. Some extremely strange interpretations are put forward in their writings. For instance, they maintain that Noah did not really build an ark at all, but that he hid inside a glowing light cloud, which we would call a plasmoid. The Gnostic texts are full of descriptions of plasma and plasmoids, often in surprising detail. When gathered together from the many texts that we now have, vastly expanded by the discoveries at Nag Hammadi in 1945, the finely edited, annotated, and translated texts of which became available at last towards the end of the 20th century, a whole world of plasma entities is revealed. Gnosticism conceived of an entire plasma universe. It seems that ancient seers were able to perceive clearly what we are only now able to demonstrate scientifically and recreate in advanced modern laboratories. Manichaeism, founded by a prophet called Mani, M-A-N-I, once stretched from Europe to China, though it has now vanished. It too was a light religion, describing plasma phenomena, its origins lying partly in the earlier Gnosticism. Gnosticism itself survived as a mass movement until the extermination of the Cathars in southern France during the Middle Ages, and the fading away of the Bogomils of Bulgaria and the Massalians of Slavic Europe at some unknown time, apparently by the 16th century. The most famous example of an intelligent glowing plasma in ancient Western religious literature is probably the burning bush encountered by Moses on the top of Mount Horeb in Sinai. I should point out to all the modern tourists who mistakenly climb Mount Sinai that it is the wrong mountain, Mount Horeb being further south, and rarely visited because there is no easy way up to it. At its summit is a magnificent temple of Hathor, whose cult image was the face of a calf. A golden Hathor calf of that temple was the golden calf of the Bible, though no one has realized this yet. The Moses story is well known to all Christians and Jews, and to Muslims as well, since Muslims are Abrahamic by tradition, and Moses preceded Abraham. The account is to be found in the book of Exodus 3:2, the second book of the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, as well as of the Jewish Torah. Moses encountered this brilliantly shining and burning plasma, which spoke to him, and he described it as being like a burning bush that was, however, not consumed by its own flames. In other words, it was not a real bush, but was round and burning as if it were a bush, which is the only way a person of that early pre-scientific time could hope to describe it. The voice may have been audible to the ears, or it may only have been mentally audible, in other words, telepathic. Although many deeply religious people, who do not necessarily study the text carefully, believe that the burning bush was God or Jehovah, the text is not clear on that point. It says actually that the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses as a burning bush, not that the Lord himself appeared to Moses. That is very different. In one of the translations, the English Standard Version, we are told, "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him," Moses, "in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush." The Septuagint is also confused, because although the apparition is said to be the angel of the Lord himself is also apparently watching. And when he sees Moses approaching, he too cries out from the bush himself and calls Moses by name, telling him not to approach closer. So who was it, the angel of the Lord or the Lord himself? As I say, this is not at all made clear by the text. This confused story seems to have only one reliable element to it. in the absence of the original Hebrew text, which was lost more than 2,000 years ago and only preserved in the Greek translation known as the Septuagint. And that element is the bush-like burning apparition that did not consume itself, but continued to burn apparently without any fuel. In other words, this seems to be a description of an encounter with a glowing plasma ball or blazing plasmoid which spoke. And encounters with such apparitions are to be found throughout the religious and sacred literatures of many countries over the millennia, and are also recorded by the more mystically inclined ancient Greek philosophers. In fact, what is described as happening to Moses is something that has happened countless times to sages, shamans, meditators, yogis, and holy men throughout the ages. An analysis of many of these encounters could shed a great deal of light upon the interactions throughout history between spiritual plasma forms of beings, whether higher entities or deceased persons. It is necessary to say more about the mysterious angel of the Lord, since this anomaly in both the Jewish and Christian religious traditions is usually ignored. Who and what was the angel of the Lord? This divine entity of the burning bush, who was not the Lord, but was someone or something else closely associated with the Lord, was known in very ancient Judaism, which testifies to the antiquity of the Moses account, by the way, but had been either forgotten or banished as heretical by the time of the sect of Judaism known as the Sadducees, who were the temple Jews of the Jerusalem temple, against whom Jesus struggled so energetically. The Sadducees were a very vicious and murderous ruling theocratic sect. Biblical scholars have discovered that during the lifetime of Jesus, the Sadducees arrested and executed more than 6,000 Jewish rabbis of the Pharisee sect, solely because they were rivals for control. The Sadducees were therefore a violent, bloodthirsty mafia, using religion as their pretext for control over society. What the Sadducees did to the more mystical Jews, such as the Gnostics, was probably even worse than the massacres of the Pharisee rabbis, though the numbers of Gnostics within reach of Jerusalem was much smaller. Some of them, the Essenes, had fled to live in caves beside the Dead Sea in order to avoid being murdered by the Sadducees. The seizure and execution of Jesus was part of a wider and uniform purge by the Sadducees of all the Jewish rabbis or religious leaders who in any way challenged the Sadducees' monopoly of power. I could elaborate on this subject and explain the real significance of the overturning of the tables of the money changers in the temple by Jesus, but this is not the place to do so, interesting as the subject is. North of Jerusalem lay the region of the Samaritans, who were a branch of the Jewish people who had escaped the control of the Jerusalem temple mafia. They preserved some of the more ancient Jewish knowledge and traditions that the Sadducees had thrown overboard. Among these was the tradition and explanation of the angel of the Lord. The Dutch biblical scholar Jarl Fossum was the first academic who explored in depth this fascinating information, which he articulated in his PhD thesis of 1981, supervised by the famous Professor Gillis Quispel, one of the world's leading biblical scholars, and in the same year in an article in a scholarly anthology entitled Samaritan Demiurgical Traditions and the Alleged Dove Cult of the Samaritans. This was later followed by his book The Name of God and the Angel of the Lord, Samaritan and Jewish Concepts of Intermediation and the Origin of Gnosticism, that was 1985, which was based on his thesis. The ancient Jewish conception preserved by the Samaritans was that the angel of the Lord was the divine entity who actually created the bodies of men, while the Lord infused spirits into those bodies. As Fossum puts it, the creation of the body of Adam from the earth is ascribed to the angel of the Lord, while the infusion of the spirit into this corpus is a work assigned to God. the Samaritans claimed to know the actual name of the angel of the Lord, which was Kabbalah, which means the secret. That's Kabbalah spelled K-E-B-A-L-A, although that's a transliteration, of course. They maintained that it was the angel Kabbalah who really resided in the sanctuary of the temple, not God himself, who remained in heaven, and that Kabbalah was the mediator between God and humankind. Moreover, his glowing or burning nature is suggested by the Samaritans calling Kabbalah the glory who fills the tabernacle. And they say that he also manifested himself as glory at the door of the tent of meeting in the passage of Exodus that commences at 21:42. The Samaritans claimed that Kabbalah abided at Bethel, which means house of God, on top of Mount Gerizim, which is the sacred mountain of the Samaritans. I cannot go further into this interesting ancient variation of Judaism, which has been lost now for nearly 2,000 years, but I wanted to offer this information to help explain the identity of the angel of the Lord for justly puzzled readers or listeners. A few years before Fossum's important researches into the Samaritans, Alan F. Siegel had partially addressed the problem in his fascinating book, Two Powers in Heaven, in which he speaks of numerous early Jewish sects, when Judaism was not yet forcibly unified by a central theological authority at the central Jerusalem temple, who insisted that God had a divine deputy, a lesser God, who did all his work for him regarding the earth and humans. Probably the most frequently occurring name for this entity is Metatron. Siegel also quotes numerous rabbinical sources regarding further details of the myth or legend of the ascent of Moses up the mountain. Some of these contain further plasmic details. For instance, there is a strong Jewish tradition that Moses was taken up from the mountain to heaven in a cloud, and a text known as the Pasikta Rabbati 24 says, "Then a troop of angels of destruction, strong and mighty, who are set round about the throne of glory, met him. When Moses reached them, they sought to burn him with the breath of their mouths. What did the Holy One, blessed be he, do? He spread something of his own splendor about Moses. This proves, according to Rabbi Naum, that the Almighty spread about Moses something of the splendor of the presence of God, which is his cloud." One is tempted to wonder if the ancient Jews somehow realized that the Kordolevsky clouds existed, perhaps as a result of telepathic shamanic journeys. One could even construe these ancient Jewish ideas as suggesting that the Kordolevsky clouds are indeed Metatron. The subject of Metatron, who was traditionally the highest of the angels in both mystical Judaism and Islam, is especially intriguing considering that there was an ancient Jewish tradition that there were two Metatrons. One was called Prince of the Countenance, and the other was called Yahoel. And one ancient text says that the Ancient of Days, mentioned in the biblical book of Daniel, is really Metatron. Metatron is also mentioned in the book 3 Enoch, and when Enoch was said to be transformed into, or absorbed into, Metatron, when he was raised in his ball of fire to the heavens. In that book, Metatron is also said to have 70 names, of which the first and chief was Yahol, sometimes abbreviated just as Yal. The Muslim name of Metatron is Mitatrush, which means the angel of the veil. In the mystical Jewish book, The Apocalypse of Abraham, Yahoel is described as the spiritual teacher of the patriarch Abraham, and who taught Abraham the whole of the Torah. The great scholar Gershom Scholem concludes that Metatron, whose original name was Yahol, was the highest of all created beings. The name Yahol was a mystic name, according to Scholem, and thus had no etymological meaning. The suffix El is, I am told, an honorary termination for the name of any angel, and means Lord in the polite sense only, not in the literal sense of the Lord. As for Yahoh, the part of the name that precedes the honorific El, Sholem points out that it is an abbreviation of the name Yahweh, whom we call in English Jehovah. But he stresses that the intention was not that Yahweh was meant to be Jehovah, but that his high status was meant to be signaled by the fact that his mystic name contained the name of the Supreme God. Sholem says that this explains the puzzling passage in the book of Exodus 23:20. Beware of him, for my name is in him. And in the Apocalypse of Abraham, Yahweh is quoted as saying to Abraham, I am called Yahweh, a power in virtue of the ineffable name that is dwelling in me. And Jewish Gnostic literature makes explicit that Yahweh was not Yahweh, but was the lesser Yahoh. This is made clear by Sholem in one of his books. That is essentially the same as saying that he was the angel of the Lord, who, as we know, appeared as a glowing ball, so that we may assume that Yahoel was one too. This subject could be discussed at very great length indeed, to the great discomfort of normative rabbinical Judaism, as Gershom Sholem, whom I was fortunate enough to know, called the dominant Judaism that exists in our contemporary world. The earliest name for God in Judaism appears to have been Elohim, and there is no escaping the embarrassing fact that that name is plural. In other words, there is little indication that the earliest Judaism was monotheistic, and the angel of the Lord was apparently left over from the earliest Judaism and only awkwardly accommodated in Orthodoxy. The great scholar of Judaism, Gershom Sholem, argues that the figure known as Moses, whether mythical, real, or partially real and partially mythical, seems to have been responsible for changing the religion of the Jews into a monotheistic religion, and for treating the earlier Jewish ideas as heretical. But those heresies persisted, nevertheless, for centuries. And today we describe them as Gnostic Judaism. They were in turn taken over by Gnostic Christianity, which was as ferociously persecuted by the Roman Catholic Church of the time, self-styled Christian Orthodoxy, as the Pharisees were by the Sadducees, self-styled Jewish Orthodoxy. But now we turn away from Moses to consider another early Jewish prophet, Enoch. Here is an encounter of the prophet Enoch with divine radiance, as recounted in the book of Enoch, in which we must note the mention of an entity called the Great Glory, which is reminiscent of Angel of the Lord, who was also called the Glory by the Samaritans. Quote, and the vision appeared to me thus, behold, in the vision, clouds invited me. I drew nigh to a wall which is built of crystals and surrounded by a fiery flame, and it began to affright me. And I went into the fiery flame, and a flaming fire surrounded the walls of the house, and its portal blazed with fire. And I entered into that house, and it was hot as fire. And lo, there was a second house, greater than the former, all the portals of which stood open before me. And it was built of flames of fire, and its floor was fire, and above it were lightnings, and its ceiling also was flaming fire. And I looked, and saw therein a lofty throne, as a shining sun. And from underneath the great throne came streams of flaming fire, so that it was impossible to look thereon. And the great glory sat thereon, and his raiment shone more brightly than the sun, and was whiter than any snow. A flaming fire was round about him, and a great fire stood before him. And until then, I had had a veil on my face, and I was trembling. Later, Enoch also relates, and they took me away to a place where there were forms like flaming fire, and when they wished, they appeared as men. In other words, he is describing higher beings who normally had the forms of plasma entities, but who could take on human form for interactions with humans. It should be noted that the Book of Enoch is an ancient Jewish work, dating from before the time of Jesus, which clearly discussed divine beings capable of incarnating as men. The Book of Enoch is regarded as a canonical work of Scripture by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, which is one of the earliest Christian churches. The Platonic philosopher Damasius, who was someone who died in 550 AD, believed that the human spirit was, quote, a radiant body with heavenly radiance, a glory that streams through its depths and lends it a divine strength. But in lower states, losing its radiance, it is dirtied, as it were, and becomes darker and darker and more material. The philosopher Philoponus of Alexandria, who died in 570 AD, believed that this spirit was a higher soul attached to the basic soul. In other words, he believed, as did the ancient Egyptians, in more than one level of soul for each person. He wrote, quote, "There is, moreover, beyond the soul, another kind of body that is forever attached to the soul, which they call radiant or star-like, and it forever keeps its radiant body, which is of an everlasting nature." The Jewish Gnostic treatise discovered at Nag Hammadi in 1945, called The Apocalypse of Adam, features Adam speaking to his son Seth and saying that before he and Eve were thrown out of the garden, they had gone about in a radiant and glowing condition. He says that when the descendants of Seth return eventually from earth to divine regions, they will all become clouds of great light. And he also speaks a great deal in general about radiant clouds of glory. In the early Christian Gnostic texts discovered at Nag Hammadi in 1945 entitled Marsanes, the narrator says, "The third shape of the soul is spherical." There is considerable unanimity amongst many of the mystical texts of antiquity that men and higher entities alike have souls that are radiant and glowing spheres. Men who become too attached to earth cease to radiate light and go dark, thus resembling the fallen angels who have become demons of darkness. Another Nag Hammadi Gnostic text, the paraphrase of Shem, is full of descriptions of heavenly clouds of fire, garments of light, luminous spirits, images of light, the power of the restless fire, the light of spirit, the exalted infinite light, clouds of power, clouds of light, the cloud of silence, which is a majestic fire, garments of fire, a power of fire and light, thought that comes forth from the light. And it says, "The righteous spark is the cloud of light that has shone in your midst." Ideas such as the garments of light and fire seem as if they might allude to the presence of plasma in and around the human body, which we will return to in the final chapters of this book. One of the most famous and impressive of the Nag Hammadi texts is the Apocryphon of John, which is dated to the early part of the 3rd century AD. It is full of descriptions of luminous clouds. Such a luminous cloud is mentioned in particular in the text's Alternative Story of Noah. The text says that the story of Noah and the Ark is not as Moses said, Moses being here presumed to be the author of the book of Exodus, but the true story is very different. We are told that Moses was wrong in saying of Noah that he hid himself in an ark because he had been warned that the flood was coming. The text insists that it was not Noah alone, but also other men. And we are told by it that they went into a place and sheltered themselves within a luminous cloud. The text also speaks of angels as being lights. However, It is not only the good entities, but also the bad entities who reside in luminous clouds. The Gnostic name for the devil is the chief archon, also called Samael, Yaldabaoth, and Soklus, which means the fool. The text tells us that the chief archon, quote, created for himself an aeon, that's a special place, that burns with the luminous fire, the one in which he exists now. The Gnostics altered the meaning of the ancient Greek word, aeon, and used it in their own peculiar way. The term aeon, the Latin form that we use in English, the Greek form being spelt differently, occurs constantly in their texts. In other words, the devil himself lives in a fiery plasma cloud. So, consequently, both the powers of good and the powers of evil dwell in or consist of plasma clouds. The war in heaven is thus a war between good and bad plasmas, and the extent to which they can recruit humans on their respective sides is assumed to have a bearing on how long the world will last before it reaches its ultimate climax when the final reckoning occurs. At that time, the elect amongst humanity, who have remained good despite all temptations, will rise up to the kingdom of light, and the powers of darkness will be annihilated. Humanity has been inundated with such accounts of what we would call, using the terminology of science, divine plasma entities for millennia. But most people have tended to disregard them as either fantasies or the enthusiastic reveries of people who were not entirely sane. But they constitute massive evidence of phenomena experienced by sensitive and meditative persons in all cultures around the world. Now, at last, science has caught up with mysticism, and modern physicists are seriously suggesting that intelligent plasma beings can exist after all. Are plasma entities to be regarded as helpful or harmful to us? The traditions are explicit that they can be both, but the helpful ones are radiant with light, whereas the harmful ones are dark and perverse, as their light has been contaminated and made obscure with the dirt of corruption. It is time that humans were given a proper briefing on this material world of the spirit. This is a short survey of some of the myriad descriptions of light phenomena in ancient religions. Of course, key events in the New Testament, such as the Transfiguration, where Jesus appeared radiant in glory, and the Pentecost, where tongues of light appeared hovering over the heads of the apostles, also seem suggestive of plasma and plasmas. Aristotle's Pneuma. Although the word plasma was only coined in 1928, some thinkers in the ancient world had an idea of it. For reasons of space, I am going to confine myself to two examples, where the ancient examples are startlingly close to our modern ideas. Something very strange was going on in the 4th century BC, and I call it Aristotle's anticipation of plasma physics and bioplasma. Aristotle, and I'll give his dates, 384 to 322 BC, is often thought of as a rather dry character who wrote profound philosophical tomes that only very serious-minded people try to read. However, the real Aristotle was very different. He published 2 books of poems, and 3 of his poems actually survive. Another thing is that he freed all his slaves, some during his lifetime and all the rest in his will. Everybody had slaves in those days in Athens, hate to tell you that. One of the reasons he had to flee Athens for his life, when he was 62 years old, is that he had written an ode to his deceased wife, and the high view he had of women was considered offensive to the male chauvinists of ancient Athens, who liked to keep women in their place, that is, either on their backs or sitting at the spinning wheel, and not allowed out of the house without chaperones. Furthermore, Aristotle was that horrible and despised thing, a foreigner. He was born in the north of Greece, and he was a resident alien in Athens. Significantly for this volume, Aristotle was the first Western thinker to postulate the existence of a rarefied form of matter entirely separate and wholly different from physical matter. He named it ether. Since physical matter was then conventionally spoken of as made of earth, air, fire, and water, which were considered elements, Aristotle called his new form of matter the fifth element. In Latin, this is quinta essentia, which is the origin of our English word quintessence. This was the first time in recorded history that plasma had been anticipated. I am still struck today by the startling boldness of Aristotle, who questioned the nature of matter in such a fundamental way. Aristotle's ether was viewed by him as a form of matter that existed in the pure state only in what today we would call outer space. It was then called the region above the moon. Aristotle thus anticipated our modern knowledge of plasma in physics. If he were alive today, Aristotle would not be surprised to be told that the sun was entirely composed of plasma, and that the space between the sun and the earth was filled with a solar wind made also of plasma. For this is what he had predicted. Aristotle went much further than only proposing that there was a higher form of matter. He actually proposed that each living physical body had a corresponding etheric body, or what is now called, by some modern scientists, a bioplasma body. We will hear much more about bioplasma bodies later on. His writing on this subject was mostly lost and survives only in fragments. Some of those lost writings were dialogues rather than treatises. It is little known today that Aristotle was as famous for his dialogues in his own day as was Plato. But such are the vagaries of what survives and what does not, that not a single one of Aristotle's dialogues survives in its entirety. And those fragments that do survive, as quotations by Cicero and others, are tantalizing in their brevity. We are somewhat luckier with what are called the testimonia, which means the descriptions of, rather than the quotations from, the lost dialogues. But even so, we get only a glimpse of Aristotle's discussions of his theories of a fifth element. It is worthwhile giving a bit more detail about what Aristotle believed, since few classical scholars have made a proper study of this aspect of his ideas. The scholar who has advanced a study of this subject the most is Professor A.P. Bos, B-O-S, of the Netherlands, who publishes most of his writings in English. He has cracked the code of many of Aristotle's ideas, which have been only partially preserved, and this has taken him decades. Much of the information that made this possible is to be found in the philosophical dialogues of Cicero, in the writings of Philo, of Clement of Alexandria, and in a fascinating essay by Plutarch of the 1st century AD, entitled On the Face Which Appears in the Orb of the Moon. The original key book by Bos, in which he began to discuss these questions, is entitled Cosmic and Metacosmic Theology in Aristotle's Lost Dialogues. That was back in 1989. But Bos has worked steadily on the subject since that time, continues to find out more and more about the subject, and has published several more books on the subject. In the book just mentioned, Bos tells us of Aristotle's fifth element, quote, "This new element is, according to Aristotle, a soma, meaning a physicality, and can therefore be counted among the natural somata," which is plural of soma, "but it does not share the hule," that means substance, "of the four earthly corpora," that means elements. For this reason, it is described as ahylon, or ahulon, possessing no hule, meaning possessing no physical body, as a kind of immaterial matter. While maintaining his belief in the divinity of the celestials, the divine beings, and their eternal existence, Aristotle bases this stance on his own new theory of the fifth element. The celestial spheres consist of the divine fifth element. End of quote. Aristotle also believed that the divine beings, as well as human spirits, were made of the fifth element, and that when we die, our spirits, made of the fifth element, return to the world of the fifth element, which he conceived of as being somewhere above the atmosphere. And of course, he viewed all stars and the sun as being made of ether. And he distinctly postulated, under the name of pneuma, that's P-N-E-U-M-A, the existence of a form of the fifth element within animal and human bodies as an animating principle. He believed that pneuma existed and intermingled with things here on earth and was, for instance, present in animal and human sperm. Pneuma and ether were related, but ether was the pure form which was restricted to the higher levels of reality, and pneuma was that lower and distinctly impure form that intermingled with and helped to animate ordinary matter. These beliefs of his later had an influence on the fundamental concepts of Christian theology, especially the Gospel of John. I won't go into more detail here about these ancient ideas, as fascinating as they are, but I want readers to know that more than 2,200 years before Crookes discovered his fourth state of matter, Aristotle had predicted it. That is more than a footnote to history. It is an extraordinary fact. I say Aristotle was the first Western thinker to suggest such a thing, because the Chinese philosophers of Taoism never accepted a dichotomy between matter and spirit. Such a dichotomy is entirely a Western phenomenon. The Chinese have always maintained that spirits were made of a very special, rarefied kind of matter like a mist. So deep do these concepts go in Chinese thinking that it is very difficult to find a Chinese person alive today who does not believe in ghosts implicitly. They always seem to have believed that very wise people never really died, but that their physical forms were transmuted into what they called xian, spelled X-I-A-N in the new spelling, H-S-I-E-N in the old spelling. These wise, deceased shamans were conceived of as living in remote mountains and forests, and flying through the air and the clouds with the greatest of ease, thinking profound thoughts and enjoying the delights of heavenly contemplation. As for most other people, they became ghosts, which were a much lower grade of being, but also made of the same rarefied semi-matter. Psychologically disturbed ghosts were dangerous, and they haunted people and places. The female ones were the most dangerous of all and were known as fox fairies. They would lure men to their doom and destroy them like vampires. A very large proportion of Chinese fiction over the ages has taken the form of ghost stories because of the Chinese preoccupation with rarefied entities made of what we today would call plasma. Anyone who enjoys atmospheric ghost stories should read those by the most famous Chinese author of them, Pu Songlin, who lived from 1640 to 1715, one of my favorite authors, and whose house I have visited in Shandong province. However, living in the Western world, as we do, I do not propose to write history of the Chinese beliefs in ghosts through the ages, or even the various texts that discuss such matters, or how they also anticipated modern plasma in a somewhat vague manner. I thought it important to mention it, for the history of the world does not consist solely of the history of the West. But I will pass over the Chinese sources because it would require a lengthy account indeed to explain the differences between Chinese and Western thinking, which alas is a vast chasm of incomprehension, and impossible to explain in a short space. Suffice it to say, that a plasma world would be less surprising to the Chinese than to Westerners. As for genuinely proto-scientific speculations anticipating plasma, I am not aware of the Chinese having produced any. It was the Taoists who promoted these ideas. They were well aware that the physical sense of sight was incapable of perceiving certain forms of matter which were invisible. Liedza, 5th century BC, says that rarefied matter eludes the senses of sight, hearing, and touch, and is therefore called by the name of yi. The Chinese character for this yi is the same as is used in the title of the famous divination book called Yi Jing, the Book of Change, as we often call it in English, or the Book of Changes, because in Chinese the same word can be singular or plural, but you don't know which except by context, and therefore also has the meaning of change, or one might better say, what changes. Laozi, and we don't know whether he was from the 6th or 4th century BC, the founder of Taoism, speaks of the invisible primeval matter in this way, quote, "The likeness of things unseen, the form of that which is without body." And he says, "What you cannot see by looking at it is called he, which means rarefaction or vacancy. That which eludes the sense of sight is called he." He also says that he and yi are the same. However, we must resist the temptation to investigate Chinese Taoism further, as it is an endless subject. The point to note here is that Laozi attributed bodiless form to what we now call plasma. He was thus not simply speaking of some primeval sludge, invisibly sloshing around us like an undifferentiated sea, but he was aware that it must be structured. One could stretch a point and say this is an ancient prehistory of the concept of a plasma crystal. Before we leave ancient teachings on plasma, I want to return briefly to recent discoveries, which we discussed in Chapter 4, that plasmas precipitate matter, and that matter is also otherwise precipitated out of nothing, in quotes. These recent scientific discoveries also resonate with ancient wisdom. Various religions from different parts of the world suggest the creation of matter as coming from speech. In Christianity, we are told, "In the beginning was the Word, Logos." You have to remember, the New Testament was written in Greek. Logos is Greek. "And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made." In the earliest form of Hinduism, the universe was said to be created by Brahma, who is an all-embracing universal spirit. He opened his mouth to speak, and he spoke the four Vedas, which are the ancient collections of sacred hymns that the Aryans brought with them from Iran when they invaded India from the west about 1500 BC. The Vedas are considered the most sacred of the Hindu scriptures and are written in an archaic form of Sanskrit known as Vedic. In ancient Egypt, the god Ptah, P-T-A-H, was said to have created the world by his speech. The wall texts of the tomb of Ramesses VII in the Valley of the Kings state of the sun, quote, "His speech is light," unquote. And in the ancient Egyptian text known as the Book of Caverns, which was preserved in the transverse chamber of the Osirian at Abydos, we read of the sun, whose name is Re, quote, "Re speaks to them through his light," unquote. The ancient mystical concept of the Logos in Johannine Christianity, which comes from the Gospel of John, also suggests that the Word of God was light. Sacred speech is essentially something that emerges from something else, just as our breath is emitted from us into the air around us. It seems that the ancient peoples, when referring to the creative speech of the primal god, were trying to convey the concept of expelled, structured breath, entering into a surrounding medium but retaining its own form and thus constituting matter. Since we now know that the universe is a seething ocean of plasma, and as it has now been proven that plasma makes dust and that dust is matter, it is legitimate to consider that the material universe has been extruded from and created by the universal plasma. In other words, the 1% is the creation of the 99%. And looked at from that perspective, the traditional religious views of the creation of matter are justified. For the spontaneously formed dust and the baryons are the building blocks of the familiar world around us. But if we look back to our ultimate origins in the world of physical matter, we are all children of plasma. The Egyptians would say we are the progeny of Ptah. The Christian view is that we are the children of God. And a Hindu might say we are all the creation of the great universal spirit, Brahma. The other early creation legends of "in the beginning was undifferentiated chaos," or as the ancient Egyptians said, the goddess Nut, N-U-T, who was a great cosmic sea, and the Torah and the Old Testament that speak of the waters, are all effectively saying the same. On this view, all physical matter did, indeed, emerge from the vast universal sea of plasma.